For thousands of years, humanity has looked to the stars and wondered, are we alone? One of the earliest recorded examples in written literature exploring alien life was penned way back in 200 AD. Lucian of Samosata, a writer of satire in Eastern Turkey, wrote a fictionalized story about a journey to the moon and the discovery of life flourishing on the lunar body. My guest today, who walks this earth more than 1,800 years after that story was written, aims to make what we call science fiction and turn it into science fact.
But there are more planets like this in the visible universe than there are grains of sand in all the beaches on Earth.
Professor Avi Loeb, who serves as the Frank B. Baird Jr. Professor of Science at Harvard University, has authored nearly 700 research articles and 5 books. He explores some of life's most amazing questions that many scientists fear to touch. And he is here to speak about his new endeavor called the Galileo Project. According to the press release sent out just today, the goal of the Galileo Project is to bring the search for extraterrestrial technological signatures from accidental or anecdotal observation and legends to the mainstream of transparent, validated, and systematic scientific research. From biosignatures to technosignatures and everything in between, stay tuned. You're about to journey inside the Black Vault. That's right, everybody. As always, thank you so much for tuning in and making this your podcast or your live stream of choice. I'm your host, John Greenwald Jr., founder and creator of theblackvault.com, and I don't want to waste any time. My special guest today is someone who's not only busy in general, but definitely today. So, Professor Avi Loeb, I am honored to have you on the show, and especially on a day like today, carving out some time for me and my audience. So, thank you for that.
My great pleasure.
And I want to get into the Galileo Project in just a few moments, but since this is your first time on my show, I always like to give guests an opportunity just to give me a little bit of background about what your role is at Harvard University, your background in science, and what is your niche?
Right. So fundamentally, I'm a farm boy. I was born on a farm, collected eggs every afternoon, and haven't changed much, I should say. I'm very much connected to nature. Was interested in philosophy early on, and I'm currently an astrophysicist, but curious about the most fundamental questions we have. And one of them is, are we the smartest kid on the block? And as we will discuss, the Galileo Project aims to answer this question, not philosophically, but actually based on evidence, because science is guided by evidence. Over the past 9 years, I've been the longest serving chair of the astronomy department at Harvard University, 3 terms, each was 3 years. Also the founding director of the Black Hole Initiative at Harvard, a center that brings together philosophers and scientists to study black holes. And I'm currently still the director of the Institute for Theory and Computation at Harvard, at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. So, and I've been the chair of a number of boards, but we will not get into that.
I know that, and you have an extensive resume, none of which would even fit in an hour, so I appreciate the overview, though. I know that many scientists have a certain angle. Is yours more astronomy, more astrobiology, or kind of all of the above?
No, my angle is that of a scientist, and fundamentally, science is about evidence rather mm-hmm. than prejudice, and that's the main point of argument that I have with the mainstream of the scientific community, because I think we should be guided by evidence, and when there is something unusual, for example, an object that entered the solar system from outside and doesn't look like any of the rocks that we have seen before in the solar system, doesn't look like a comet or an asteroid, we should consider the possibility that it is a plastic bottle among all these rocks like we find on the beach when we walk. across the beach. And so my point is, we should allow ourselves to learn something new, rather than always assuming that what we see in the sky is something we have expected from before. And that's the way science is done. We learn new things by paying attention to evidence. And, you know, fundamentally, it's a lesson that I've learned from practicing astronomy over decades, that we should be modest, that sometimes nature is more imaginative than we are. And if you ask me about this particular question, whether we are alone or whether there is a smarter kid on the block, we know now that roughly half, plus or minus a quarter, of all the sun-like stars have a planet the size of the Earth, roughly the same separation. And if you repeat the same circumstances, you might as well get similar outcomes. That to me sounds like common sense. I don't think it's a speculation to say things like us may have already existed out there. And in fact, most stars formed billions of years before the sun. So if there was a technological civilization that predated us, let's say by a billion years, it could have sent AI systems that replicate themselves through 3D printers and fill up the entire Milky Way galaxy by now, because it takes much less than a billion years to traverse the distances across the galaxy. And my point is, let's be modest, let's be humble, let's not assume that we know the answer in advance, and simply check the sky and figure out what is around us. And, you know, that's just like opening the curtains on our windows and checking whether we have neighbors. If you argue, no, we don't have neighbors, and we are the smartest in the universe, it doesn't get rid of the neighbors. You know, they might still be out there.
Before we drill down on exactly what your angle is with the Galileo project, you touched upon these objects, and I believe you were referring to Oumuamua, which I also want to get into. But first, I want to tackle science and scientists in general. Is there a hesitancy to deal with that topic when you're talking about not microbial life found on a distant planet, but rather an intelligent life that's traversing the cosmos in whichever way that they have figured out to do so? Is there a hesitancy to that in the broader nature of all this?
Definitely. I mean, it's being regarded as an extraordinary claim to argue that something like us may exist out there. And frankly, I think it reflects arrogance, because I don't regard us as very intelligent whatsoever. If you look at human history, you know, we wasted most of our resources in fighting each other, trying to feel superior relative to each other. The Second World War was driven by racism, you know, Nazi Germany. And the $4 trillion were spent just by the US economy on that war, and the 75 million people were killed in that war. Two-thirds of the Jewish population in Europe was killed, 6 million. And so all this devastation was for nothing, just for the image that some people are superior relative to others. And that doesn't show intelligence, because intelligence, in my mind, is cooperation and sharing of evidence-based knowledge. And that's what science advocates. And to assume that we are really unique and special, I think, is arrogance. So my point is, I don't think it is speculative at all to search for things like us, or maybe even more advanced than us, because I don't think that we are very advanced at this point. What's the problem about just collecting evidence, searching for that? My argument is, extraordinary conservatism leads to extraordinary ignorance, as we know from the days of Galileo Galilei, when the philosophers refused to look through his telescope and argued that the sun moves around the Earth.
You named your project the Galileo Project. Give us an overview of what it is and what is it that you're trying to find.
Right. So the name Galileo was obviously chosen for the reason I just mentioned, that there were these philosophers that refused to look through the telescope because they knew the answer. That only maintained their ignorance. The Earth continued to move around the sun. The fact that Galileo was put in house arrest didn't change anything. In fact, 2 weeks ago, there was a paper written by a philosopher published in Nature Astronomy magazine, arguing that this strange object that we referred to before, Oumuamua, that didn't look like a comet or an asteroid, could not have been of artificial origin. And when I saw this paper, I thought to myself, haven't we learned something from the days of Galileo, that philosophy is not the way to settle such issues? What we need is a high-resolution image, because they say a picture is worth 1,000 words. In my case, a picture is worth 66,000 words, the number of words in my book, Extraterrestrial, that I wrote about this object. I wouldn't need to write the book if we had a high-resolution photograph. It's not a philosophical question. And so that is the rationale behind the Galileo project. What we want is to get more evidence on objects near Earth that look weird and that we do not know the nature of. So Oumuamua, this object that was that came from outside the solar system, the first one that we discovered that came from interstellar space near Earth, that didn't look like a comet or an asteroid, is an example. And if we find more of the same, we might want to send a spacecraft equipped with a camera that will take a close-up photo of it. But in much the same way, there were these unidentified aerial phenomena in the Pentagon report to Congress exactly a month ago, whose nature is unknown, and the government admitted that. But the government collected data from jittery cameras in a fighter jet, relying on eyewitness testimonies and so forth. This is kind of a data set that is not suitable for scientific inquiry. And what we want to do is construct telescopes where we have full control over the way they are operating and collecting data from our sky in a scientific way and analyzing it. It will be open data, our analysis will be completely transparent. Since we're not taking the data from government-owned sensors, there are no restrictions on using. It's just like doing astronomy. In astronomy, you look at distant objects. Here, one would look at nearby objects, but again, using telescopes. So every time we look at the sky in a different way, we discover new things. And so my point is, we will learn something new, even if UAP, these unidentified aerial phenomena, are a result of some rare atmospheric phenomena, like lightning or something that was not expected because the government doesn't know what they are. We will figure it out, a team of scientists, and resolve this issue and learn something new. If we learn that Oumuamua, this object from 2017, ends up being a chunk of frozen hydrogen the size of a football field, something that was suggested, we will learn something new. It's not something that we've seen before. It was not produced in the solar system. And therefore, we learn something new no matter what. It's a win-win proposition. The worst thing we can do is say business as usual and ignore those anomalies that are in the Pentagon report to Congress and in the discovery of Oumuamua.
What really caught my attention with your press release and the press conference that you guys put out today, which, by the way, well done. For those who want to see the full press conference, the link is down below. I definitely recommend to watch it because it goes into great detail about what Professor Loeb and his entire team are doing with the Galileo Project. But what I want to ask you is, earlier I asked about the hesitancy about scientists talking about alien life traversing the cosmos and the apprehension to go there. But with unidentified aerial phenomena as part of the scope of what you're doing, can you help me understand the difference with your project, how you're going to approach something that is in our atmosphere? I mean, are you looking at UAPs that literally are very close to Earth, or are you using the term to reference something that may be in or around our solar system?
No, we are using it in the same way that the Pentagon report used it. And The point is that we will have a network of telescopes looking at the sky. The sky is not classified unless you are next to a military complex. And we will simply monitor the sky the way astronomers do, except we will pay attention to things nearby rather than things far away, so they move much faster. And usually if a bird flies above a telescope of that looks at distant forces, people ignore it. The astronomers just don't pay attention to it. But for us, it will be an object of interest. And of course, we will need a computer system equipped with artificial intelligence to figure out which objects we want to follow on and monitor and study. And the idea is to develop many such systems depending on the funding. So I should say the foundation for this project was that 2 weeks ago, several individuals came to me after reading my book and listening to some of the 1,000 interviews I had since the book was published 6 months ago. It's translated to 25 languages. It's very broadly read. And a few wealthy individuals approached me and said, here is some money that no strings attached, you can use for the purpose of your research. And I was really grateful to those people. I didn't engage in any fundraising. So I now have $1.755 million from those people that I didn't have a few weeks ago. And I decided to establish this project by assembling a team of exceptional scientists that we have, and also a scientific advisory board of very distinguished scholars and that will advise us. And altogether, it's the first scientific project that is well-funded, that will collect data on these objects, unidentified objects in the atmosphere, as well as interstellar objects outside the atmosphere, like Oumuamua, and we'll analyze it with, of course, the hope that maybe one of them, by the way, we don't need more than one to originate from an extraterrestrial technological civilization, because that would already have a huge impact on humanity when we realize that there is something out there. And it, unidentified objects may be a mixed bag. Most of them might have mundane explanations, but it's not really about most of them. It's about the one that would appear really strange and that cannot be explained.
I'm just curious, and I think I know the answer. You didn't name the donors, so I assume they're anonymous?
No, they're not anonymous. You can find their names on the philanthropic advisory board that is listed on our website.
Oh, okay. I thought they were not named, so I'm glad I asked. Okay.
No, okay. So the press release was, or conference was not about the gift.
Sure.
It was more about the project. And we are really grateful for these generous individuals that committed funds. And the hope is that we will be able to raise 10 times more funding, because with the current funding, we can perhaps put 10 to 50 telescopes in various locations. But if we had 10 times more money, then we could do a much more rigorous job in surveying a big chunk of Earth for any unusual objects.
Was there a turning point for you? And this is kind of a personal question, but when it comes to the either extraterrestrial objects in space or those that are much closer to home here on planet Earth, was there a turning point for you? Was that Oumuamua, or was there something else that made you really say, okay, we need to, if money should ever arise, and here it is, put it towards UAP research of these types of objects? Is there an event like that for you?
Yeah, definitely the discovery of Oumuamua. Before that, I was working on cosmology, the study of the universe, the first stars that formed in the universe, the scientific version of the story of Genesis. And I pretty much pioneered this frontier and have two books on it. I started working on it when very few people were interested. I also worked on black holes, and I worked on the dark matter in the universe, gravitational waves. Topics that are part of the mainstream now that early on were not necessarily part of the mainstream. And that taught me an important lesson, not to pay attention to how many likes I get on Twitter. That's not really relevant. I need to keep my eyes on the ball, not on the audience. But then when Oumuamua showed up, I actually was interested, because a decade earlier, we wrote the first paper with two collaborators, Ed Turner and Amaya Moore Martin, the first paper that forecasted how many rocks do we expect to find coming from other stars based on what we know on the solar system. And we predicted that the telescope in Hawaii, Pan-STARRS, will not find any by a factor of 100 to 100 million. So it was really off the scale of it finding it. And then it found Oumuamua. And that was surprising to me. And I monitored the data on it. At first, astronomers assumed that it must be a comet, but then it didn't show any cometary tail. There was no gas or dust around it. And then as it was tumbling, the amount of light that it reflected changed by a factor of 10, implying a very extreme shape, most likely flat, pancake-like. And then it showed an excess push away from the sun, most likely by reflecting sunlight, because the push declined inversely with distance squared, like you expect from reflecting sunlight. But that required a very thin object, which I argued nature doesn't produce. And in fact, in September 2020, there was another object found, given the name 2020SO, and it ended up being a rocket booster that we launched in 1966. And it had thin walls, and it also exhibited an excess push away from the sun by reflecting sunlight, no cometary tail. So here you have it, an artificial object that we produced, behaving just like Oumuamua. Wow. And was not necessarily designed to be a light sail. So for that reason, I now think maybe Oumuamua was not designed to be a sail pushed by light. Perhaps it served another purpose. One possibility, maybe it was a receiver trying to collect data from probes that were distributed in the solar system a long time ago. But we don't know. We don't have enough data. And of course, it's still possible. Maybe it's a very unusual rock that we've never seen before, like some of my colleagues argue. My point is we should collect more data on future objects, get a photograph, and that will set the issue.
Is that, with the money that you have, feasible to put cameras? I don't know the cost, so that's why I'm asking. Like, is there at this point a absolute goal of what you can do with the current funding and then obviously what you could do with expansion?
Yeah, so with the current funding, we can get 10 to 50 telescopes, roughly the size of 10 inches. You can buy these telescopes off the shelf. Just the other day, I was looking online. If you wanted to get a megapixel image of an object the size of a person at a distance of a mile, you can do that with a 1 meter telescope, a telescope that has a diameter of 1 meter. And I found it online, and you can click add to the bag, and it costs $500,000. So apparently there are people that are adding such a telescope to their bag for $500,000. I don't have such a bank account, but otherwise it wouldn't be offered to add it to your bag. But at first we will, so what I'm saying is with such a telescope, you could resolve the size of the head of a pin on an object the size of a person. You know, it's a megapixel image. And you could read off the label that whether it says made in country X on Earth or made on planet Y, far away from Earth. You can tell the difference. And that's all you need. Now, we will start with a network of somewhere between 10 and 50 telescopes that are smaller than that, maybe 10 inches in size. And each of them will be equipped with a camera that gets the data and then transfers it to a computer system that will filter out the data, because there would be a huge flood of data with a continuous video that you take of the sky with a large number of pixels. And we will have to filter out the objects of interest using artificial intelligence. So the idea is to deploy a lot of these systems, telescope plus camera plus computer system, in different locations and monitor the sky. So with the $1.755 million we have, we can definitely have at least 10 of them. But if we got 10 times more funding, we can put at least 100 times of them. You know, the number of telescopes that we use is just proportional to the amount of funding we have, because each system is independent. And of course, with 100 of them, we can do much better. We can cover many more regions.
How do you choose the spots?
Excellent question. This is to be discussed. And of course, there is a claim that perhaps the UAP are clustered around the military constellation, maybe nuclear reactors, some special areas. It's not clear whether that's just a selection effect, whether we are patrolling these areas much more than others. And of course, that would be part of the study, because the best places to put these telescopes are actually mountaintops where you find astronomical observatories. They have very good seeing. There is not much blurring by the turbulence in the atmosphere. And you can look a great distance towards the horizon in search for such unusual objects. So it would be very beneficial in terms of visibility to place such telescopes in astronomical observatories. But the question is, will the UAP be there? Or maybe they prefer to be somewhere else.
You mentioned the military and around military installations, and obviously we do see an influx of that by the admission of the U.S. government. Is there any, or will there be any coordination with the military or the U.S. government, since you are putting in an effort to investigate what the government has said that they are investigating? Any connection?
Well, the point is the government is using classified sensors that are used for national security purposes. And obviously, most of the data is classified for that reason. I would much rather not look at that data, because then there would be restrictions on what I can do. Because even subconsciously, if I had a peek at their data that is classified, they would be concerned that will guide my assembly of data. And I would much rather be completely independent, doing it in the scientific way, just like astronomers look at the exploding stars or distant galaxies. Nobody forbids them from doing that. And, so what's the difference of an object very far away, billions of light years away, versus an object that is just next to us? You can use telescopes in astronomical observatories, and nobody prevents you from looking at the sky. And the idea would be to do it in the scientific way, so measuring quantitatively what we find, and rather than relying on eyewitness testimonies. You can't use that in scientific papers. So my goal, if you ask me globally, is to bring this subject to the mainstream of science, because the public is very curious about this question. And if we do that, then we will get more funding to science, because the public funds science. And the proof to that is that I got, nearly $2 million in 2 weeks. I didn't do any fundraising. And we can attract a lot of young people to science. And the proof to that is that my inbox is full now, just a few hours after the press conference, with young people asking to join the project and volunteering to contribute from their time to the study. And, that's remarkable. People are excited about this question. They want to help the project succeed. And what I'm saying is, it's a lost opportunity if scientists would continue to shy away from this subject as they did in the past, because you can tap the enthusiasm and promote our knowledge of the universe. And my point is, it's a win-win proposition. Even if we learn that there is some rare atmospheric phenomena, or that there are hydrogen icebergs being produced in some nurseries in space that we've never imagined, we learn something new. So we cannot lose by getting more data. We can only benefit, because we'll get a better understanding of reality.
Do you ever think about why the government doesn't share the majority of the data? You mentioned the classified systems. I'm 100% on board with you there, and I get that. But do you feel that there's another wall that is shielding that data and being shared with the general public, with scientists such as yourself? Because there's a lot that they could share that would help you implement the Galileo project and placement of instrumentation and so on, if you had more data that wouldn't be tapping into classified systems. Do you ever wonder what they're hiding?
No, I think it's mostly for that reason that you mentioned, that the data is classified because it was taken by classified sensors, and there is a lot of bureaucracy along the way that prevents the release of this data. And I can give you an example. There was a meteor. That's an object that collided with Earth, that burned through the atmosphere of Earth, that was found in 2015. And with my student, we analyzed the data that was released, and it was detected by government-owned sensors. And they just published some data about this object without giving error bars, without stating how uncertain they are about the trajectory. But we used that data to say, wait a minute, it moved too fast. This object must have come from outside the solar system. And it was 2015, so we said, this is the first detection before Oumuamua of an interstellar object. And it was an interstellar meteor. And we submitted the paper for publication. And then the referees, the reviewers of the paper argued, well, we want to see the error budget. We don't trust the government. So I had some colleagues that have connections across the fence. And I said, could we get, even if not the error budget, just an upper limit on how uncertain the government is in terms of the parameters of this particular object? And it took months and months, and eventually I got an upper limit. So I submitted the paper with my student, Amir Siraj, to the journal and said, we just got this information that this is the upper limit. And then the reviewer said, I don't believe the government. So then the editor of the journal said, okay, we'll find a reviewer that has access to the classified information and we'll be able to report back and say, yes, this paper deals with data that is reliable. He couldn't find such a person. So then the paper was never published, and I did my best. And this just illustrates to you the gap that there is between open data science and government data. All we needed in this case is to say, okay, the speed of this object was some number plus or minus some other number, and we were missing the plus or minus. So if they said, like, I don't know, 20 kilometers per second plus or minus 5 kilometers, then that would be it. That's all we needed. But they were not, it took months. At best, we got an upper limit, but that was not satisfactory. The paper never got published. So it shows you the difference in the systems of science, open science, and government-owned data. And as a result, you know, I think the best approach forward in terms of identifying the unidentified is to collect new data. Let's not obsess with old data. Let's just collect new data. You know, I'm practically behaving like a kid. You know, when an adult tells a kid, the truth is like that, the kid just ignores the adult very often and says, I want to figure it out myself. That's how kids get bruised, how they get into trouble, because they don't listen. So I basically prefer to get the data myself. And that's the way science operates. You know, science is based on, you know, it's maintaining the childhood curiosity in a way that you need to reproduce your evidence. It's not enough to rely on a one-time miracle or a one-time event that someone told you about. What you want is to be able to reproduce the claim. And that's what we can do with the Galileo project, by finding new objects using telescopes in an open data framework without me knowing anything about the past. And that's the approach we take.
It seems like transparency is a goal of the project, which you've been talking about. But how is that data going to be shared, if you don't mind me asking?
Oh, in a very simple way. We can just put it on the web.
And it just for is it like the raw science data for other scientists around the world to take part? Is it sharing?
So this is very common it's not always the case in science. Sometimes groups, teams that collect data prefer to keep it to themselves so that they can harvest the fruits out of that data before anyone else has access to it, because they invested a lot of the time in constructing the instruments that were used to collect the data and so forth. So that exists, and there are some projects where the data is not available to everyone else for a few years and then it's available. But the approach we will take is that the data will be available as soon as we have it and as soon as it can be used by others. And I think that's the best approach, because other people may look at the same data and infer something different from it. And we want to allow that rather than filter the data that other people can see.
In the last 6-7 minutes or so, I wanted to ask you, I'm hoping I could ask you about a little bit of speculation on when the Galileo project, let's say you implement everything and you make that discovery and there's something really is out there that confirms you, what has been your aim now for many years. Have you speculated of what that would be? I mean, what is it do you feel that we would run into first?
Well, you know, as a physicist, a scientist, I'm actually a theorist, someone that tries to interpret data rather than someone that collects the data. These are called observers in astronomy. And for me, if I get a data set, I immediately start to think how to explain it. You know, there are lots of anomalies in astronomy. For example, we don't know what most of the matter in the universe is. It's called dark matter, and that's an anomaly because we haven't seen it. There are other anomalies. So whenever you see something unusual, immediately I start to have ideas in my mind that, you know, in directions that could explain it. And that's what I will do in this case. And I will try to use what I know about physics to provide an interpretation and an explanation for the data. And of course, other people might use other ideas, but it's just like it's often done in science. So if there is a good interpretation or several competing interpretations, then you try to collect more data and rule out those that do not fit the new data. And it's just like a detective work. And in my book, Extraterrestrial, I refer to the work of Sherlock Holmes that basically said we need to put all possibilities on the table and rule them out one by one, and whatever remains must be the truth.
So when it comes to that alien life, though, and this is that speculation that has fascinated me. I work as a television producer and did quite a few shows on this very topic. And the thing that blew me away was the idea that mainstream science and scientists were really playing with the machine intelligence, the artificial intelligence, that when we do find out we are not alone, it would essentially be with a non-biological entity, rather a mechanical one. And when I first heard that, I fully admit, I laughed. Dr. Seth Shostak at SETI was the first one years and years and years ago who had brought that up when I was producing the show. Long story short, I was blown away because after actually researching it and doing numerous shows for History and Discovery on it, I mean, I'm convinced. Can I throw that idea to you? Is that what you lean towards? Do you think about that aspect of what type of intelligence you might find?
Definitely. I mean, and that was featured in some of my recent commentaries in Scientific American. You see, humans or any biological creature on Earth was not selected by Darwinian evolution to travel between stars. You know, in fact, we wouldn't survive for more than 1 year in space without proper protection because of cosmic rays. That's often missed by people like Elon Musk that advocate going to Mars and settling there. First, you need perhaps to dig caves for people to settle into because there is no protection. And if you put people on Mars for a year, a substantial fraction of their brain cells will get damaged by cosmic rays because Mars doesn't have an atmosphere, doesn't have magnetic field to protect those humans, first travelers. So you're sending them to their death if you're not protecting them. And as a result, you know, it makes much more sense to send instruments because you can imagine creating instruments that will survive even for billions of years through space. And now we are at the point where we develop artificial intelligence systems that could potentially outsmart us, you know, self-driving cars and in the future much better systems. And I can imagine sending one of those systems to space such that, you know, we train it, we educate it, just like we train our kids. We provide them with a blueprint for how they should behave in life. And then we send our kids into reality, into the world, and they operate autonomously. And the same should be true for those AI systems that might have been sent by other civilizations. And of course, there is not enough time for them to get guidance once they're on their way, because the distance between stars are so huge. The nearest star to us is 4 light years away. And so it takes light 8 years for a round trip. And that's the nearest star. So if you are sent from a star across the galaxy, it takes tens of thousands of years. There is no way that the system would wait for guidance in order to decide what to do. And so if you have artificial intelligence, the system is sufficiently smart to make its own decisions based on its experience and based on the blueprint that it was prepared with. And the question is, of course, what guides it? I mean, what kind of information is it seeking? What is its objective? And to figure this out, if we ever encounter such a system, we will need our own AI system. So it sort of resembles the situation where you find new content on the internet, but you cannot fully understand it. And then you ask your kids to interpret it for you because they are much more computer savvy. And we might need our own AI systems to interpret their AI systems. And if they outsmart our AI systems, you know, they might win this Darwinian contest. And it's not clear that we would survive after contact.
What's interesting is you have AI working with you on the Galileo project to help and assist you on the way. And that in itself would lead into a fascinating second hour, which I would love to have you for. But hopefully, Professor, you'll come back. It was a pleasure. Let me ask you one last thing here in the last 60 seconds. Take as long as or as little as you want. I know you have a tight schedule today. Is humanity ready for such a discovery?
No. I think most people prefer to stay in their comfort zone and basically believe that we are unique and special because that flatters our ego. And it reminds me of my daughters when they were young and they were at home, they tended to think that they're the smartest in the world. And when we took them to the kindergarten on the first day at school, they had a psychological shock because they met kids that might be smarter than they are. And of course, if I were to ask them, they would say that they prefer to stay at home to maintain their illusion. So for that reason alone, I think that most people prefer to believe that we are unique and special. But it makes no sense to ignore reality because then you are not accommodating properly. And guess what? One day, a smart neighbor will knock on your door and it will be too late.
Absolutely fascinating conversation. I know you have a packed day today. Thank you so incredibly much for taking the time. Obviously, I wish you the absolute best of luck with the Galileo projects, but I do hope that you come back and share your updates whenever time permits, because I know my audience absolutely loves this. I absolutely love it. And I'd love to dig into more of that AI / machine intelligence, because I just love that. So thank you so much.
And thank you, John. And if people are interested, they can follow my commentaries in Scientific American every week. And it's also on my webpage at Harvard University.
Perfect. And a full breakdown of all the links and everything for Professor Avi Loeb is below in the show notes. So make sure you check that out, including the press conference. Thank you again, Professor. Really, really enjoyed it. And thank you all for listening and watching. This is John Greenwald Jr. signing off, and we'll see you next time.